This is disc number 7.
Abigail glanced down the chimney, Lawrence's headlamp just a pinpoint of light 70 feet below. Thought of the night he left, all those years ago, her first concrete memory. And she wondered if, as her father watched her climb to the surface, leaving him stranded in the dark, it felt anything to him like it had to her the night she'd watched him walk out of her bedroom door. "You marooned us in a deeper cave than this, and you never came back. How do you forgive that? You deserted a 4-year-old girl whose world you made turn round. You made me feel worth leaving. How do I forgive that? If I don't come back, Daddy, no one will ever hear from you again." Her head emerged into the blizzard as she scrambled out of the cave. Nothing but a hole on a steep, snowy slope, rimmed by 3 feet of powder. She checked her watch. 12:32 a.m. She'd been underground for 20 hours. Her fingers, arms, and legs were cramping, and she stood high on a mountain, wind howling in pitch black, whiteout conditions, with no idea where she was or how to find abandon. 1893. 65. The next morning they took the air, walking together down Main, the sky midwinter blue, the sun lifting over the East Canyon wall, and the unshaded snow already too brilliant to look at. The fires had gone out in the mercantile and surrounding hillside cabins, so the air smelled cold and crisp, rinsed of wood smoke. Harriet looked up at Stephen, squinting, though the bonnet gave ample shade to her eyes. She thought it strange to be with this young preacher who treated her like a grown-up, asked her opinion of things. This had not been her experience with Daddy.
"Where did God take the people?"
she asked, and not for the first time since last night. When Stephen stopped and squatted down, his webs sank another foot in the snow.
"Harriet," he said, "I already told you I don't."
Something had moved above them. He glanced up at the second floor of the hotel, saw Molly Madsen standing in the bay window staring down at them. He grimaced as the ulcer in his stomach flared. They fought their way through deep drifts blown against the brick building, finally emerging into the lobby of the hotel.
"Go play at the billiard table, Harriet."
Stephen removed his smoked specs and unlaced his webs, then climbed the stairs. In the dark hallway, he knocked on her door, and when she asked who was there, he replied, "Stephen Cole." The door opened. The preacher blushed. Though colder in her room than in the hall, Molly had clothed herself only in a sheer chemise. She stood shivering, breath steaming through corpse blue lips.
"When I saw you on the street, I thought you were my Jack. I'm expecting him any moment now."
"May I come in, build a fire for you?"
"Oh, well, yes, that would be fine."
Stephen stepped inside, laid his felt hat on the desk as Molly shut the door after him. Her suite smelled like a nightjar, though it wasn't the filth that struck him as much as the loneliness. It had holed up in this room, overspread the sad gingham walls, the chipped furniture, its wilting occupant. He knew Molly's situation, the abandonment and humiliation that had festered and atrophied into madness. He'd visited before, but always from the hall. She'd never invited him in, and in truth, he'd been glad of it.
"The furnace is over here,"
she said, leading him to a pot-bellied stove across from the bed.
"Mr. Packer has always provided assistance of this nature. He's a dear friend and business associate of my Jack, though he hasn't come around lately."
Stephen counted enough logs stacked against the wall to heat the room for a day, maybe two. He balled up several sheets of old newspaper, so brittle they flaked apart in his hands. With the fire going, he said,
"Why don't you come sit over here?"
Molly knelt before the open stove, her eyes glazing as she watched the aspen logs blacken in the flames. Stephen grabbed the dusty quilt from her bed and draped it over her shoulders, then unbuttoned his coat, eased down beside her.
"Molly," he said, "the town's been vacated."
"Everyone left? Even Mr. Packer?"
"Him too. And I'll soon be leaving, so I was hoping I might persuade you to come with me."
"What if Jack comes and I'm not here? If no one is here?"
"We'll send word to Jack the moment we reach Silverton. I'll even pay for the tele—"
"But that isn't how—
I'm supposed to be sitting in the window, looking down the street. And then I see him walking toward the hotel, and he sees me up here in the window, and he doffs his hat, and I smile, and he runs up the steps and down the hall, and... She lost her breath. It's okay, Molly. I will be here when my Jack comes to abandon. Who'll bring you food and water? Wood for the stove? Who... Jack will see to these things. He is my husband, after all. Molly, Stephen said, and the words tempted him. You've been in a band in 10 years, this hotel for 5, and you'll die in this room if you don't leave with me. You've got as much a chance of seeing Jack again as those sagebrushes did of making their fortune in this desperate town. Instead, Stephen stood. Would you excuse me for a moment? He left the suite and hurried down the stairs toward the lobby and the clack of ivory balls. The child had made a game of rolling them, 3 at a time, into the table's leather pockets. The preacher slipped back into Molly's suite, found her basking in the heat of the stove, staring into the smoldering pile of embers. The room now reeked of wood smoke, a great improvement. He sat with her again, said, "I was hoping you'd tell me of Jack." Her face enlivened, and as she spoke, Molly veered into sanity, Stephen catching peaks of the woman she must have been. She narrated their first meeting in San Francisco, and the ball, their courtship, the first time he kissed her, and finally, the wedding, straying into the smallest details of the clothing worn, food served, floral arrangements, guests in attendance. Everything is clearly recalled as if the event had transpired that morning. Stephen marveled at how thoroughly she described her husband's face, the tone of his voice, even the smell of him. So by the time she pulled out the crinkled albumen print of Jack, Stephen's mind had already formed an excellent likeness of the man. Someone knocked at the door. Molly rose from the warmed floorboards by the stove, crossed the room, and asked who was there.
"Harriet McCabe, ma'am."
Molly opened the door, looked down at the little girl standing in the hall.
"What do you want?"
Harriet's eyes cut to Stephen, back to Molly.
"There's a man in the lobby asking for you."
Please God, let her believe the lie she so loves, Stephen thought.
Molly staggered back.
His name?
Jack Engler, ma'am.
Molly flushed, glanced back at Stephen. He came to the door, said,
"Harriet, I want you to go downstairs and tell Mr. Engler that Mrs. Engler will send for him momentarily. Hurry now."
As Harriet ran down the hall, Stephen closed the door. Molly glanced at her chemise, which was stained and threadbare, a pitiful garment. She whispered,
"He can't see me like this."
Stephen went to the wardrobe, threw open the doors. The dresses and gowns hadn't been worn in years. All were mottled with gray dust. Molly chose a corset, much too small, but Stephen fit her into it as well as he could manage, hooked the 2 bones in front, and laced up the back.
"Which gown?" he said. "I happen to like this blue."
"Jack detests blue."
She detached a peach-colored evening gown with plentiful ruffles from its hanger.
"A lovely choice, Molly."
He pulled it over her head, helped her slide her arms into the sleeves. As he swept the dust off her shoulders, he felt as if he were dressing an oversized child. Her hands shook. Stephen steadied them, said,
"Don't be afraid. Your husband is down in the lobby because he loves you. He's come back for you."
He sat Molly down at the dressing table. Her hair hadn't been brushed in a long while, thin, oily, so tangled that he hesitated to run bristles through it. So he picked up the silver brush and slid the smooth backside of it down the length of her coarse black tresses. Molly's reflection in the cracked mirror sent back the rubble of a woman, and Stephen prayed she didn't see herself as he did, that God might cause a beautiful distortion of the image her eyes received. While he pretended to brush her hair, he considered Jack, wondered where this man lived today, and if he ever thought of the woman he'd deserted, this mad, pathetic creature of obsession, wished Jack could see what he'd done to his bride.
"You're stunning," Stephen said.
"I don't have any rouge."
He pinched her cheeks.
"There, you're perfect now."
As Molly beamed, Stephen glimpsed the dignity she'd once possessed. He went to the door, cracked it open, yelled, "Harriet, Mrs. Engler is ready to receive her husband."
Stephen shut the door. Molly walked over, her chest billowing beneath the shabby gown. She stood 3 feet back from the door, Stephen behind her. They listened to the heavy footsteps thumping up the stairs. Molly glanced back at Stephen, grinning with all the giddy joy of a new bride, thinking of the first day she'd arrived in advance of her husband in this fledgling camp called Hope. And all the things she'd wanted to do, places she intended to see, children to bear, tore through her mind like an avalanche. She'd waited so long. Now he was coming down the hall, and Molly whispered, "Oh, Jack." As Stephen thumbed back the hammer, raised the revolver to the back of her head, and waited for the knock at the door. 66. In the evening, Stephen went for water, blessed with convenience in this regard since the hillside behind his home boasted a spring. The cabin's previous occupant had raised a simple structure over the rock where the water surfaced, so it could be easily accessed in the winter months. A lantern in one hand, an empty pail in the other, he webbed 50 feet up the trail, past the privy and toward the shed, the moon so bright that he could have left the lamp behind. He stepped under the tin roof and traded the lantern for an axe that hung from a nail in the clapboard. Ice had amassed around the lip of the flat rock where the water spilled over, and when he chipped it clear, he set the pail under the trickle and sat contentedly on a dry rock, blanketed, like all the others in this old tailings pile, with an orange flocculent mass. He'd always assumed it was algae. A solitary cabin glowed on the east slope above Abandon. Though you couldn't see inside, since the windows weren't made of glass, but white cotton cloth soaked in tallow. It was a cramped, one-room, saddle-notched affair with a mud and stone chimney, a little porch out front, and a corrugated metal roof that stayed warm enough with a fire blazing underneath it to keep the snow from sticking. Inside and out, it was a Spartan dwelling, severely lacking the touch of a woman. Stephen pulled 2 enameled graniteware pots off the fire and hustled them over to the rustic table where Harriet sat waiting for supper. He eased down onto the deacon seat and lifted the top from the larger of the 2 pots. Steam bellowed out. The slumgullion simmered. He spooned a serving of stew into Harriet's bowl, then sliced her a piece of sourdough bread and lathered on several spoonfuls of wild raspberry preserves. One of his parishioners had left the bread and jar of jam on his doorstep Christmas morning. He dipped Harriet's tin cup into an earthen vessel he'd bought off a Navajo trader, filled her cup with water, then poured himself some Arbuckles from a spotted pot, allowing himself a sip of coffee before ladling the stew into his own bowl. He blessed the meal. It needed prayer. The stew was horrendous. So wanting of salt and spice that it held all the complexity of dirty water with chunks of gristly elk meat and potatoes and cabbage bobbing on the oily surface. But his new guest slurped it down without prejudice and even asked for more. After supper, Stephen prepared Harriet's bed on the mattress he'd taken from the McCabe shack earlier in the afternoon. For pajamas, Harriet wore her underclothes, Bessie's peignoir, too long and bunched up around her feet, and a pair of drafty socks sewn from flour sacks. Stephen made Harriet turn away while he slipped a flannel nightshirt over his union suit. "Would you like a story before we go to sleep?" he asked. Harriet stood at the foot of his aspen bedstead, looking at the old newspaper that served as wallpaper, tacked to the logs.
"What would that be like? You've never had a bedtime story read to you?"
She shook her head, and Stephen realized it owed to her parents' illiteracy. He got up from his mattress, just a bunch of burlap stitched together and stuffed with pine boughs, and walked over to the railroad tie mounted to the stone above the fireplace, the shelf serving as mantel and bookshelf. He chose a scuffed, well-used volume, called Harriet over to her bed before the hearth, and tucked her in under the quilts. She lay between Stephen's legs with her head in his lap, and he read for 10 minutes by firelight from The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. He closed the book when he thought she'd fallen asleep, but as he tried to extricate himself without waking her, Harriet's eyes fluttered open and she said,
"What happened to Miss Madsen?"
Stephen touched the back of his hand to the young girl's face. It was soft and cool. He gently wound one of her pitch-black ringlets around his finger.
"Molly was very sick," he said.
"Like scarlet fever?"
"No, in her head. God told me to end her suffering, so I did.
How did you?
Do you know how a gun works?
They hurt you.
They can. I shot a bullet into the back of Molly's head so she wouldn't be sick or sad anymore.
Did it hurt her?
It killed her body, but her soul never felt a thing.
You gonna shoot me in my head so I go to Jesus?
No, Harriet. You've got a long and happy life ahead of you. She closed her eyes. Stephen ran his fingers through her hair until she fell asleep. Harriet awoke. The fire was dying, and though her feet were cold, she could still feel the warmth of the flames on her face. The sound that had roused her from the dream came again. She sat up on the lumpy mattress, looked over her shoulder at Mr. Cole's bed in the corner against the wall. The preacher had buried his face into his pillow, and he made strange, sad sounds. Harriet took her doll and got up from the mattress and walked over to his bedside.
"Hey,"
she said. Mr. Cole lifted his head off the pillow. Even in the low light of the cabin, she could see the wetness on his face, knew what it was.
"What are you doing up?"
"I heard you being sad. Is the wet because everyone's gone?"
Stephen wiped his eyes and sat up against the wall, his long legs hanging off the bed, feet touching the freezing dirt floor. Harriet climbed onto the mattress with him.
"I'm sad for a lot of reasons."
"Like what reasons?"
"Well, mainly because God told me to do a very hard thing, something I didn't think he was capable of, or me for that matter. But I did it, because we have to obey God, always. And now
he wept again.
"I feel like I don't know him anymore, like he isn't who I thought he was. And that's fine, he's perfect, whatever he is. That's my failure to make naive assumptions about his nature. Then the devil constantly tells me these lies, whispers in my ear that maybe it wasn't God who spoke to me, that it was actually him, the evil one, or that this horrible winter, this town, the thin air, the greed, all that took my mind from me."
Harriet pried open the fingers of his right hand.
"What's that?"
In Stephen's sweaty palm lay an ornate sterling silver hairpin. He let Harriet hold it.
"It's a hairpin,"
he said.
"What's that?"
"A piece of jewelry a woman uses to hold up her hair."
"Why you got one?"
He smiled. "Fair question. It belonged to a woman named Eleanor."
"Was she your wife?"
"No."
"Is she dead?"
"No, Eleanor isn't dead."
"You know, you kind of favor her. She had black curls like yours, dark eyes."
"Did she give you this?"
"We were picnicking on the beach late one afternoon. This was 10 years ago, second worst day of my life. I had taken her there to tell her I couldn't marry her."
"Why?"
"Because God told me to go to divinity school instead, to spend my life serving him. It was a windy day and the wind kept blowing her hair loose, so she pulled out her 2 hairpins and stuck them in the sand. I swiped one when she wasn't looking. I suppose I shouldn't have. You know how you hold Samantha at night and she makes you feel better, safer?" The child nodded. "That hairpin is my Samantha. When I hold it on hard nights, lonely nights like this, it makes me remember things about Eleanor, her eyes, the way she smelled, the sound of her laugh. And it makes me sad, makes me miss her. But it also reminds me that I was a very happy man once."
"You wish you stayed on the beach with Eleanor?"
Stephen gathered his hair and tied it up in a ponytail. "No, Harriet, I don't wish that, because that would be wanting something in conflict with God's will. But I'll tell you what I do wish. Wish we could live twice, take a different path each time. That at the end of all this, when I finished serving God in the West, I could go back to that day on the beach, put a ring on Eleanor's finger instead."
"Maybe you can still go back."
"Eleanor's married to a lawyer named Benjamin. They live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, with 4 children, last I heard." Stephen lay back on his side, his head on the pillow, watching fire shadows move like black ghosts along the walls of his wretched cabin. He managed to cry softly this time, Harriet patting his back,
telling him with the simplistic, heartfelt wisdom of a 6-year-old that he would wake up in the morning feeling brand new and happy again, how sometimes her daddy made her very sad and lonely and afraid, but that the feeling always passed, and that it would be the same way for him. They slept in Stephen's bed, and neither woke until just before dawn, and only because the fire had gone out turned the cabin cold. 67. Lana Hartman had gone without food and water for 2 full days. She lay against the cold rock floor, watching the sole light source burn in the middle of the cavern. A miner's friend, too weak to reach the gaunt and hollowed faces that lined the walls. That first night locked in the mountain, the noise had been maddening. Miners trying to beat the door down, quarreling, guns firing, children wailing. But most of the miners had left in search of water, and with the cavern quieted down, she now strained to hear the hushed voices. Crying, prayers for deliverance, some praising God, others cursing him. A pair of long hairs debating philosophy, theories concerning the soul after death. Lana closed her eyes. Sleep came in intermittent bursts of nightmare and fever dream. When she awoke, the thunder in her head had increased 2-fold, and Joss Maddox knelt beside her, stroking her hair. It took her a moment to latch onto Joss's voice. The worst of it? Wish Cole hadn't met with the skullcracker. Love to hear him defend the behavior of his loving God. He cares so much for us. This is one anti-godland fucking way of showing it. You're hurting, and you ain't done shit to deserve this hard fucking deal. If I could do something for you, Lana, swear to holy Christ I would. I come to ask if you'd go with me. I'm leaving this fucking tomb, going into the cave, see if I can't find water, some way out. Lana cut her eyes at Joss. The barkeep's face distended and malformed in the lantern light. That a nod? Lana moved her head again. All right. Here, let me help you up. Hope you ain't too weak to walk, 'cause I'm too damn weak to carry you. Joss lifted the shadow gi she'd stashed with Al's body, lighted the candle, and set out with Lana into the cave. They progressed slowly, guided by candlelight, soon leaving the man-made tunnels and passing into karst terrain. Traveling from room to room, Joss holding the shadow gi at head level to avoid walking into stalactites. An hour out from the main cavern, they entered a small grotto. Water seethed out of the floor into a rimstone pool, and Lana ran to it, already on her knees and bringing a cupped handful to her mouth. Think you might regret that. Lana stared down at the spring, tiny bubbles streaming up from cracks in the bottom, the surface appearing to boil. She touched her tongue to it, the water bitter and caustic, heavily alkalied. Poison them, don't you bet? Still, Lana almost drank it. She watched the water slip through her fingers as Joss swiped extra candles from the 2 dead miners. The hall echoed with the noise of the waterfall, the light too gentle to show its vast dimensions. They stood on the shore of a subterranean lake, its bed of white crystals shining under the rays of firelight that shot out through the perforated can. The shadow gi clanged against the rock, and the women fell to their knees, bent down, put their faces into the water. Lana coughed up the first 2 swallows, but when she finally got some down, it was so cold and good it made her head ache. They sat on the bank, drinking until their stomachs bulged and Joss had to loosen the button on her canvas trousers. She said, Lana, you don't want to know what I'd do to have 1 cigarette left in my dream book and some Mexican commandoins. Few hot rocks, menudo, bottle of mezcal. Keep thinking I hear someone banging the angle iron. Tell you what, I'd swear off whiskey for a meal. They wandered on inside the mountain, nothing but rock and shadows and firelight, Lana feeling certain that days must be passing for all their time in this underworld. She was halfway through one of Haydn's concertos when Joss stopped, turned around, and said, I think we better try to go back. The way her voice carried, Lana pictured them standing in a large cavern. I don't have clue fucking one as to our coordinates, but maybe Stephen came back after all, or they got the door open. Hate for us to miss that blowout. Lana shook her head. What? She reached down, touched her feet, grimaced. Oh, you're tired? Well, hell, I am too. Maybe we should catch 40 winks first. Let's find a decent spot. They went a little ways farther until they found a room where the rock was level.
"You're sweet, Miss Hartman," Joss said. "Hope you find everything to your liking. Here, we have some rock. Over here, some more rock. Oh, and here's some more fucking rock. I hope you like rock."
Lana smiled.
"Ain't seen many of those."
68. The two women lay on the rock, nestled together for warmth and blanketed under Lana's woolen cape and Joss's serape. Lana's headache had eased since she'd filled her stomach with water, but the reprieve of pain only made room for the deep hunger. Joss said,
"We got 3 candles left. I hope that'll get us somewhere better than this. I'm blowing us out for a while."
Lana heard a puff and the room went black. It was perfectly silent, cold. She felt Joss take hold of her hand.
"Believe this shit? I don't. Guess it beats turning into a cottonwood blossom, bag over my head, rope around my neck, squirming before a bunch of damn strangers. You warm enough? Squeeze my hand if you are."
Lana squeezed.
"Good."
They were quiet for a while, Lana wondering if sleep would come more easily in the absence of psychotic thirst.
"You always been a mute? Squeeze once for yes, twice for no, 3 times for shut the fuck up, Joss."
2 squeezes.
"Just curious is all. I take no offense. You spoke recently, like in your adult life?"
1 squeeze.
"How long since you went quiet?"
3 soft squeezes.
3 years?
1 squeeze.
"That sound you hear is the wheels turning inside my head. Wondering what the fuck happened to you. Was you met upon by some horrific occurrence?"
1 squeeze.
"Somebody hurt you 3 years ago?"
1 squeeze.
"A man?"
Squeeze.
"Cocksuckers all. Was you a whore?"
2 squeezes.
"This the work of your husband, or?"
1 squeeze.
"Let me venture a guess. He caught you stepping out."
2 squeezes.
"Well, as our mode of communication would take about 4 fucking centuries to unriddle this mystery, I'll leave it at this. You're a sweet human being, and for whatever reason you caught a rough shake, and I'm real sorry, and I wish it hadn't."
The ceiling glowed, both women gasping as the moon edged into view. Nearly full and faintly yellowed, the color of ancient paper, their rocky prison shellacked with placid light.
"I shit you not. This is the first piece of luck I ever had."
The moon's brief framing in the chimney window ended, and it shrank away, continuing along its predestined path across the sky, stranding them once more in the darkness. Joss held the shadow gi above their heads and stared at the ceiling.
"You lift me, I believe I can scramble up that. Squat down."
Lana knelt and Joss straddled her shoulders.
"All right, raise me up slow-like."
Lana stood, surprised by how light Joss was, barely 100 pounds, and the weight soon lifted off her shoulders. Joss began to climb, holding the shadow gi in her teeth, clawing her way up the rock, the candlelight dwindling. Lana glanced around at the darkness on all sides.
"Fuck!"
Joss had stopped, perched 15 feet up the chimney, muttering to herself. Then she was moving again, but coming back down, the room rewarming with candlelight. Her legs dangled through the bottom of the chimney. She dropped to the floor, took the shadow gi out of her mouth, said,
"Look here, Lana. Only one of us can go up. I want you to."
Lana shook her head.
"No? Want to know what you got in store if you stay here? Whoever climbs up that chimney's got to have the shadow gi to see, 'cause you can't hold no candle in your teeth. I'll leave you with 3 candles and 2 matches. No matter what happens, I'd say it's a long chance I ever make it back to this room, which means you got to find the mine again where everyone else is at. Your candle has the luxury of blowing out twice. After that, you might as well sit down and wait to die. In darkness and quiet like you never seen, and all alone, just you and your thoughts. Me? I'd much prefer to take my chances with whatever's on the bright end of this hole."
Lana shook her head, her chin twitching.
"I ain't locking horns with you on this. You know enough about me to know I operate on the smoky end of the spectrum, so this ain't no easy offer to make. I would suggest you take me up on it before the notcher in me rethinks the situation."
Lana pointed at Joss and turned her hands over, palms up.
"Don't worry about it. I've always survived. I'll get myself out of this, jam the breeze back to everyone else, Look, I've done plenty of awful things, and not many of them ever keep me up nights. But leaving you here in the dark ain't something I care to haul around in my head, poking at what few shreds of conscience I still possess. Savvy?
She handed Lana the shadow gi and tied up her wavy black hair.
Now I'm squatting down now. I better feel your fucking heft on my shoulders.
2009. 69. It was more snow than Abigail had seen in her lifetime, waist deep and still dumping. With the headlamp on, her visibility ended after 10 feet. Without it, the world lay as dark as the cave she'd crawled out of. Her options whittled to climb or go down. She chose to descend. And between the 12,000-foot oxygen-deprived air and the energy it took to walk without snowshoes in a meter of powder, she had to stop every few steps to catch her breath. The slope steepened. A gust of wind knocked her down. Twice she banged her knees into blades of rock hidden beneath the snow. A half hour out from the cave, the slope terminated at a cliff. Abigail knelt down, shone her lamp over the edge, her stomach knotting as she watched the flakes spiral into darkness. She had no idea how far it dropped, but she resolved that no way in hell would she be going that way. Instead, she traversed a descending line along the edge of the precipice, her face going numb again, fingers freezing, lightheaded from the elevation and the lack of food and water. Soon she'd left the cliff behind, working her way down a small drainage filled with the murmur of a creek and the twilight of its season, trickling under the snowpack on its path to wider waters. She spied tall, slim profiles in the gloom below. She passed through alpine shrubland, winter-crippled timberline trees, then finally emerged into a forest proper. The firs drooped under their loads of powder. A branch caught her hood, snow raining down her neck. She ducked under a canopy of Douglas fir branches that dipped low enough to provide some semblance of shelter. She pulled off her gloves, dug the ice out of her collar. It was so quiet in the forest, with only the creak of straining fir trees and clumps of snow sliding off branches. She was very thirsty, but she refused to take any water or supplies from Lawrence, recalled telling him she'd just eat snow. She scooped a handful into her mouth, chewed the ice, squeezed out several drops of water, then spit it out. Her head ached. She'd been cold. Now she was colder. A howl erupted nearby. It rose slowly and faded slowly, with all the heart sickness of an elegy. She'd never heard that sound in the wind, and while it tripped all the primal fear triggers in her hard wiring, she still found it lyrical and haunting and deeply sad. It rose up again, closer now. And from some place high above, perhaps that shrouded peak she'd descended, a collection of howls answered, their voices sweeping in a lonely cascade down through the forest. Abigail glimpsed something bounding through powder. The wolf stopped 30 feet away, buried to its neck, ears flattened, hackles spiked, regarding her with its head cocked, as if in wonderment that a human had ventured out on such a night. Eyes glinting in points of yellow fire, long incisors shining as it bared its teeth. Abigail blinked and it was gone. She got up, pushed on through the forest. After a while her watch beeped. 3 a.m. She realized she'd been traveling downhill for some time, and that worried her. Abandon stood at tree line, but she'd gone well below it now, by as much as 1,000 feet. She turned back and ascended through the forest, taking the steepest line she could find, back up into deeper snow, thinning trees, using saplings to haul herself upslope. Just before dawn, she passed through an odorless stand of trees stripped to their trunks, an ossuary of burned evergreens. This barkless, coneless, leafless blackened wood, mass-murdered some time ago by an electrical storm. At timberline, she stopped to rest, beyond exhaustion, legs cramping, nauseated with hunger. She'd sweated out all her water, and she made herself choke down a few handfuls of snow as the sky shifted from black into gray, the first progression toward dawn. She sat shivering against a crooked, twisting runt of a tree, watching the gathering light shape out the wilderness around her. Snow came in spits now, and though the wind had slacked off in the forest, she could hear it moaning through the crags above. Dawn dropped anchor. She'd hoped to see the only landmark she knew, those jagged granite teeth of the saw blade, but the cloud deck had decapitated everything above 12,000 feet. Then she saw it, a ways up the nearest slope, the tiny cross of Abandon's church puncturing the low gray clouds. She stood. The town itself lay just a quarter of a mile ahead. She could already see the other structures, and a tinge of pride coursed through her.
I found it in the dark, in the middle of a blizzard. Not bad for a city girl.
The possibility that Quinn was still out there flashed through her mind. She turned off her headlamp and waded on into the Box Canyon. 70. Main Street lay empty, 19th century wind chimes tinkling discordantly in the doorway of what had been the Mercantile. Abigail stood between the saloon and the hotel, looking up at the bay window, that vantage point from which she'd first seen Isaiah or Stu through the red filter of Emmett's camera. She studied the snow in the vicinity. With their tracks from Monday night now a day and a half old, there should have been no trace of them under 4 feet of snow. And yet she saw tracks, at least one fresh set, that moved into the hotel, then south toward the pass. Abigail waded over to the entrance, stepped through the doorframe. She banged her boots against the brick and knocked off the ice, then turned on the headlamp and swept it over the collapsed staircase, the archways, the front desk. Her last time in this hotel lobby, late Monday night, Scott Sawyer had been lying under the lounge's archway. Now the only sign of him was a dark stain on the floorboards. She made a cursory inspection of the lounge, glancing under the billiard table, behind the fallen elk head, wondering if Quinn had found Scott, stowed him elsewhere. If Scott had brought the keys to his Suburban with him on their Monday night photo shoot, she could forget using his truck. It was 17 miles from Abandon to the trailhead, another 10 from the trailhead to Silverton. 27 miles. Farther than a marathon, in deep snow, at altitude, sleep-divested, and without food or water.
If my cell doesn't get service at the pass, that's what I'm in for. Might as well get going.
She heard a boot step on broken glass, across the lobby, in the dining room. She rushed toward the doorway as a shadow darted out from behind the bar, footsteps coming after her, crunching over the shattered chandeliers, her heart slamming in her chest like a thing that wanted free. Before she reached the entrance, something grabbed her left arm and a gloved hand squelched her scream, dragging her back from the doorway, pushing her down behind the front desk. Her headlamp illuminated Scott's face.
Scott! Oh my God, you're...
Shh! Someone was here just 15 minutes ago.
Who?
Didn't recognize him. I heard footsteps in the snow, so I hid behind the bar.
How are you alive?
He raised his down vest, yellow fleece jacket, and thermal underwear top so Abigail could see where he'd duct-taped the knife wound closed to stop the bleeding. The right half of his abdomen bloated and inflamed. It hurts like hell, and I thought I was dead when they first stuck me. The blade nicked a rib, but it missed my vital organs. I faked it once those men in masks showed up. Hoped if they thought I was dying, maybe they'd just leave me tied up, which is exactly what they did. I came to consciousness last night, managed to free myself. I've been resting, gathering my strength to go out and look for everyone.
Well, they're all dead because of you and my father, she thought.
Abigail leaned back against the desk, could have fallen asleep inside of a minute.
The three masked men, she said. Ex-Special Forces.
Three? I thought there were only two.
Your trustworthy assistant was the third.
What? Scott ripped off his headband, ran his fingers through his bleached-out hair.
Apparently Jared found out the real reason you and Lawrence had come to Abandon.
If he caught the edge in her voice, Scott didn't show it, just said,
So what happened?
She told him everything except that they'd actually found the gold, and when she finished, Scott put his head between his knees and sat absolutely still and silent. Though by the light of her headlamp, Abigail saw tears splattering on the floorboards under his face.
I killed them,
he said. She put her hand on the back of his neck.
No, you.
No. I was their guide. They just came out here to see Abandon, take some stupid fucking pictures, and we used them for their backcountry permit.
Jesus Christ.
Scott, I know you're upset, but we have to go for help right now. Lawrence won't last long in that cave when the water runs out. Now my cell's in my backpack at camp. If I get service at the pass, hopefully we can get somebody out here.
Scott looked up and wiped his face. He stood, limped off into the dining room, returned with his pack.
He handed Abigail two Clif bars and an Nalgene bottle,
The water's got 2 packs of emergency in it. Get that in you. It'll help replenish the minerals and vitamins you've lost. You'll need a serious energy boost for what's ahead of us. 71. They struck out south toward their campsite, choosing a route behind the buildings in an effort to remain unseen. Despite his wound, Scott moved quickly through the snow, and soon they'd left behind the row of false-fronted cribs at the end of town. Up canyon, Abigail spotted the boulder standing on the outskirts of camp.
"I recognize that rock," she said. "The tents are just beyond it."
As they passed the boulder, Scott said,
"Where's our stuff?"
He went out ahead of her, moving in frantic circles through the area where the tents had been.
"I'm not believing this," he said as he dug in the snow. "Quinn must have taken our gear. Everything's gone. Even Gunter and Gerald."
"Who?"
"The llamas.
Fucker better be packing a fucking arsenal if he touched my boys."
"You're sure the tents aren't just buried? The snow would have covered them, right?"
"See this?" Scott knocked the powder off the top of a pyramid-shaped boulder that barely jutted out of the snow. Lawrence put his tent up right here by this rock, so he could lay his things on it. Now all his stuff's gone. But cross your fingers and your toes. Scott waded over to another boulder, this one capped with 4 feet of snow. "I never set my tent up Monday night," he said. "I was too busy fixing supper, helping everyone else get settled into camp. I was going to do it when we got back from photographing the ghost town. What I'm hoping is that by the time Quinn found our camp, enough snow had fallen to bury my big pack, which I left beside this boulder."
Scott ducked under the snow. A moment later, he popped up, hoisting his internal frame Dana-designed backpack like a trophy above his head.
Abigail worked her way over to him.
"What do you have in there?"
"Everything. My tent, extra clothes, first aid kit, sleeping bag, more bottles of water, a gas stove, food. I don't think we'd have made it without this."
He brushed the snow off his solid black pack and loosened the compression straps.
"Please tell me you have a cell phone.
Hate the fuckers."
"So we're hiking out. 17 beautiful miles."
He dropped a big compression bag in the snow.
"But no worries, I'll whip us up a meal before we go."
He reached into the bag, emerged with 2 packets of backpacker's pantry freeze-dried dinners.
"What's your pleasure? Paella with saffron rice and chicken, or turkey stroganoff?"
Within the hour, they were on the move again, heading toward the saw blade, swaddled in ashen clouds. After a half mile, Quinn's tracks branched off from the canyon and climbed the slope toward Emerald Basin. They pushed on, taking turns breaking a trail through the deepening powder. By the time they reached the ruins of the Godsend, the drifts came to Abigail's chest.
"Let's take a breather," Scott said.
They collapsed near the stamp mill at the foot of that steep white slope that swept up 2,000 feet into the clouds.
"What happens if Quinn sees our tracks?" Abigail asked.
"Yeah, I've been worried about that."
"I mean, he will eventually see them, right?"
"Probably. And you're exhausted. I'm hurting. He won't have to travel that fast to catch us, and he has one hell of an interest in our never leaving these mountains. I'd feel a lot better if it was snowing like a bastard. We're target practice out here in the open."
"You got a gun in your pack?"
"Jared kept the pistol with him." Abigail squinted down canyon, subconsciously searching for a tiny figure plodding toward them through the snow.
"I'll bet Quinn has a gun," she said.
"What we have to do is get as much of a head start as we possibly can. I was listening to my weather radio in the hotel last night, and it sounds like it only snowed above 8,500 feet. If we can get down that far, we should be safe. He won't be able to track us. But as long as we stay in the snow, it's just a matter of time."
Abigail struggled to her feet, gave Scott a hand up.
"Then let's get going," she said. "I'll lead for a while."
1893. 72. She used her thumb to pull the hammer back.
"Good. Now put your finger right here."
He eased it onto the trigger.
"No, don't squeeze yet. Not until you're ready to shoot something."
"I'm ready."
"What are you aiming at?"
"Our cabin."
The hammer snapped down on an empty chamber.
"Okay. Now what if you want to shoot it again?"
She worked the big hammer back.
"Perfect.
This time I'm shooting a chimney."
Snap.
"I think you've got it."
She heard harness bells ringing a couple hundred feet below, the burrows growing antsy. The preacher took the gun from her and broke it open, dropped shiny cartridges into the chambers.
"This becomes dangerous now," Stephen said. "It'll be loud."
"Why are you crying?"
He gave her the gun, took a wipe from his frock coat, and dabbed his eyes.
"Don't draw the hammer back till you're ready to shoot it."
Peering through snow-clad branches, she saw the mule skinner emerge from an empty cabin across the canyon.
"See him?" Stephen asked.
"That man sold his saddle like Miss Madsen?"
"He's even more sick in the head. You want to help him, don't you? Send him up to guard with everyone else?"
"Uh-huh."
"You keep the gun inside your cloak until you get close. I don't want you trying to shoot him until he's as near to you as that fir tree."
"Will it hurt him?"
"No. Like Molly, he's already in great pain. You're making it go away. After the first shot, he'll fall down. You be real careful, and you pull that hammer back again, and you walk up to him and shoot him in the head."
The sick mule skinner shouted,
"Anyone here?"
And his voice so faint and lonesome, rising like a prayer from the canyon floor.
"I don't wanna."
"I know, but it's time."
"I'm scared."
"Nothing to be scared of, Harriet."
"You do it."
She handed him the gun, but he shoved it back.
"God told me this chore falls to you, that you're his little angel of darkness, and he allowed me to save you for this very purpose. Do you see the perfection of his grand design? Please, Harriet, go end that poor man's suffering."
"If I do good, you'll dope me with the sinker and some raspberry jam?"
"I promise."
"Mr. Cole, is God gonna give me new ones?"
"New what, honey?"
"Daddy and Mama."
Stephen stared down into Harriet's dark eyes.
"I'll be caring for you."
"Bethany's daddy was the best I ever saw. She called him Papa."
Stephen blushed.
"Well, I suppose that would probably be all right if you wanted to, you know, call me that."
Harriet smiled.
"Okay, Papa."
The little girl pushed through the trees and stepped out in front of the mott of firs. He watched her through the branches, webbing downhill, hands concealed in her cloak just like he'd told her. He looked over abandon, the empty smokeless cabins, the cribs, silent dance hall, his dark chapel on the opposite slope, and he couldn't stop the thoughts, remembering that first day he'd arrived here by stage, the town pure energy in motion, the new sawn yellow boards of the buildings and the smell of fresh-cut wood, streets a soup of mud and shit and garbage, crowded with horses, buggies, pack trains, sidewalks jammed with miners, packers, whores, gamblers, con men, everyone trying to fill their wallets, eyes electric with a peculiar mix of misery, lust, and manic greed.
"Who are you?"
"Stephen Cole."
"No, who are you?"
"Gods, no.
Faithful, you murdered. Servant, an entire town."
A gunshot rolled through the canyon.
Thinking, "I am your faithful servant, I 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 am your faithful servant, faithful, faithful, faithful."
His head fractured with molten pain, and he fell unconscious before the second shot rang out. 73. It was a 21-burrow pack train. The first six animals loaded down with burlap sacks holding 3/4 of a ton of Packer's gold. The next 15 bearing stiff riders, all fastened to their mounts with one long macat. Ezekiel Curtis, skin a plum shade of scarlet, burned from the cold and high-altitude sun, frozen straight through, an eviscerated Bart Packer, his 4 servants, Russell Ilg, Molly Madsen, the album imprint of her husband shoved down the front of her corset, Billy McCabe, a faceless Otha Wallace, the still-warm mule skinner, and the 4 other men the preacher had murdered in the day-hole on Christmas night. It was dusk, the snow falling in big, patient flakes. The preacher sipped from the tincture of arnica and prayed for the 5th time in the last hour that God might ease the awful pain in his head. From his vantage, he could see the soft glow of his cabin across the canyon where Harriet slept. He slapped the rear haunches of the last burro, the animal brayed, and the pack train shuffled on into the mine. Stephen dropped the Shadow Geese on the floor of the tunnel and pulled the key out of his pocket. As he worked it into the padlock, the hair on his neck stood erect.
It's been 3 days, he thought. They must be dead by now.
He dropped the crossbar on the rock, lifted the lever, the bolt retracting, pushed the iron door open with the toe of his Arctic. When the noise of the rusty hinges died away, he listened. Silence. He knelt and lighted the rest of the Shadow Geese, carried them inside 3 at a time, setting the lamps on the rock around the door. Then he walked back up the tunnel to the end of the pack train and quirted them on. The donkeys hesitated, reluctant to enter the mine. He slapped their bony rumps with the Riata's braided rawhide.
Get on now.
They inched forward, carrying their cargo, the tunnel resonant with the clack of hooves on rock. He drove the burros through the iron door and followed them into the mine. They bunched up near the entrance, huddled together and braying nervously. Stephen went to work cutting loose the burlap sacks and hauling the gold bricks into a nearby alcove. Then he severed the horsehair rope that attached the dead to the burrows and shooed the pack train out of the mine and back up the dayhole.
It is finished.
There, he shouted into the cavern. All yours, for all time. He reached down to lift the Shadow Gee. Fingers touched his Arctic. He shrieked, tripped, and fell as he moved for the door. What crawled toward him in the firelight seemed neither man or woman, and barely human. Lipless and toothless, a dried-out shell of a person, it whispered words undecipherable, its inflated tongue lolling out of its mouth like a piece of jerky. Stephen raised the lamp, and in that trembling firelight, he saw the throng of abandon in the cavern, most dead, a dozen or so dragging themselves in his direction, beggars searching for crumbs of light. The one who touched his boot reached out for him, bulging, lidless eyes desperate for an end to their living death. Stephen wept as he backed into the tunnel and pulled the door shut. He stood there for a moment, listening to a weak fist pound the iron on the other side.
Please, God, end their suffering. How does that glorify?
It stopped him mid-prayer. Framed in that oval of charcoal light at the far end of the tunnel, a silhouette, too tall to be a child. 74. Main Street lay empty, wind chimes gossiping in the doorway of the mercantile where Lana barged inside, unsheathed Joss's bowie, and stabbed the blade into the first sack she could get her hands on. The burlap split. Flour poured onto the board floor. She brought a cupped handful to her mouth, and despite the feeling that she was yamping from Jessup, the Merc's owner, nothing ever tasted better. On her third mouthful, she spotted the jar of elk jerky sitting on the counter, made a break for it, using the knife to carve bite-sized pieces, devouring 5 strips before her stomach offered the first rumble of satisfaction. Lana stared at the fresh set of tracks through town, which looked too orderly to have been left by a herd of passing deer. She stood listening for any sound beyond the scrape of snowflakes collecting on her cape, cold and sore, having hiked all day since climbing out of the cave, through zero visibility and ungodly deep snow, just to make it back to abandon. She gazed up the east slope, searching for the mine where they'd all taken shelter Christmas night. What she saw instead, obscured by the falling snow, were figures near the rim rock. Heathens. She squinted, but instead of hostiles, her eyes sharpened the features of 3 burros bearing their riders into the mountain. She post-holed north up Maine, the snow coming to her waist, her feet mercifully going numb again, panting when she finally reached the chapel. By the time she arrived at the base of the rim rock, the burros had disappeared into the mountain. The canyon fading toward a night she would never survive without roof and walls and fire. When she caught her wind, she fought her way up the last of the burro trail, finally standing just inside the opening to the mine. This warm passage smelled of trail-worn animals. She heard water dripping, harness bells, the clap of metal into rock. Her eyes discerned movement in the dark, something coming toward her up the passage, and she started to retreat when the first burro moved by, out of the mine, back down the slope toward abandon. It took a minute for the pack train to depart the mine, and as the last burro ambled past, a man shrieked from someplace deep inside the mountain. Lana ventured 3 steps into the mine. A speck of firelight flickered a ways down the tunnel, and a door slammed shut. Someone knocked on it. Someone wept and whispered, and then abruptly hushed. Water dripped. Metal clanged into metal. Outside, the jingle of harness bells dwindled.
"Are you real?"
The man's voice, thick with tears and something familiar about it, a refinement, the subtlest drawl. Then footsteps pounded up the tunnel again, and not a hoofed animal, but the softer squeak of boots on wet rock. Lana began backpedaling toward the opening, glancing over her shoulder into the snowstorm and the blue dusk.
"No, don't be afraid."
The footsteps coming faster now. She knew this voice. The preacher, Stephen Cole, emerged from the shadows, geed up, utterly wasted, gray-skinned, eyes bloodshot and black-ringed, hair unwashed, more like a creature sprung from the innards of the mountain than abandoned spiritual compass.
"Miss Hartman, what are you doing out here?"
He'd stopped just a few feet away, both of them close enough to the opening to be stung with the razor cold of stray snowflakes.
"Weren't you in the mine with everyone else Christmas night?"
Lana nodded. "A band of heathens rode through town just a couple hours ago. They're on the peck. Nearly raised my scalp. Everyone's still in the mine. I've been bringing food and water, extra candles. Packer's gold's in there, too. That's what all the burros were carrying." It suddenly clicked. Stephen had hidden in abandon since Christmas night, eluding the heathens, waiting for an opportunity to bring provisions to those who had holed up in the mountain. She felt a shot of relief and admiration. Hoped Joss had made it back to everyone else in the main cavern.
"Come with me. We're not safe out here, particularly with night coming on."
Lana looked once more down into abandon. Nothing to see but snow and darkness and... A single grain of light burned on the other side of the canyon. A firelit cabin. When she turned back, the preacher had lit a shadow gi, and he stared intently into her eyes, offering his hand.
"Don't be ringy. You need to come with me right now."
She didn't take his hand, but she did walk beside him into the passage, and as they went on, candlelight glinting on the slickened sides of the day-hole, a strange thing happened. Her mouth ran dry and her heart raced, and as rays of firelight reached the iron door at the tunnel's end, she realized what it was. The preacher's eyes, his voice.
"You need to come with me right now."
A predatory insistence bordering on desperation that she'd seen in another pair of eyes, heard in another voice 3 years ago that awful night in Santa Fe, and though it made no sense, she knew at some gut level that the preacher intended to kill her. They reached the door and Stephen fished a key out of his pocket, slid it into the keyhole of a large padlock. He turned just as she lunged at his back, the blade refracting shards of firelight. Stephen swung his arm down onto her wrist, and it might have knocked the bowie to the rock, but Lana had momentum and a ferocious grip. The blade sank into his thigh. The preacher screamed, and Lana saw him reach into his frock coat. Lana was running now, enveloped in darkness. She tripped on the uneven rock, fell as a revolver thundered. Her ears ringing, she scrambled back onto her feet and hauled toward the oval of dark gray in the distance, glancing back. Flare of fire, another gunshot shattering the passage. 10 seconds of hard running brought her out of the tunnel and into the early evening light. She followed the burrow tracks under the rimrock, moving as fast as she could manage downhill toward abandon. The hood of her cape blown back, snow pouring into her hair, down her neck. It was the preacher's cabin glowing on the west slope, she figured. Had he lied about the heathens? Devised some way to murder the entire town? On Main Street, Lana bent over, gasping, petered out. Saw the preacher already halfway down the slope. She looked south toward all the dark, empty buildings. She could try to hide, but he'd hunt her all night. North of town, she spotted movement. Took a moment to realize it was just those burros Stephen had driven out of the mine, congregating at the livery. Inside the barn, an albino, still saddled and toting a slicker roll, stood eating a bale of hay. When Lana grasped the harness, the horse threw his head and whinnied, but she held firm and stroked his neck. Her arctic slipped into the stirrup, and she stood and swung her other leg over and settled into the saddle. She took up the reins and gave him a little kick, and he trotted out of the stable, halting under the overhanging roof. The snow had let up, and a bit of moon shone through between the clouds. There was nothing left of dusk, and a voice whispered that she would die out there if she did this.
Gonna die here if I stay.
In the last light, she glimpsed the profile of a man hobbling out of town, heading toward the stables. She dug the heel of her Arctic into the horse's side and rode off into the dark. 2009. 75. The wind was storm force at the saw blade, blasting through the gap in streamers of freezing fog, the pass blown clean of snow. Scott held up a small yellow instrument with a digital display, locking arms with Abigail to keep her from being blown off the mountain. They took cover on the lee side of the pass behind the palisade. Scott clipped a couple of carabiners onto the hip belts of their packs and short-roped them together. He leaned over, shouted in Abigail's ear, "My Sherpa clocked that last wind gust at 51 miles per hour. Stay close!" As they started down, Abigail couldn't help but think it a good thing the clouds had socked them in, so she couldn't see the sheer drop that awaited even the slightest misstep. 2 days ago, she'd freaked out on this part of the mountain, been paralyzed by vertigo. Despite the relentless wind, the rocky trail near the top lay under 3 feet of snow. Scott led, Abigail close enough behind so she could touch his pack if she reached out. They descended slowly, painstakingly. Before each step, Scott stabbed the old ski poles he hiked with through the snow to probe the depth and check the ledge width, ensuring they didn't stumble onto a cornice. Abigail followed in his footsteps, trying to ignore how the oval of her face, not protected by the hood of her Gore-Tex jacket, was progressing once again from burning into numbness. The wind let up the lower they went. After the 6th switchback, Scott stopped to unclip their carabiners. Where they stood, in the upper realm of the cirque, the wind had diminished to a soft, icy breeze. They dropped out of the clouds into a boulder field, the snow having buried all but the largest rocks, the lumpy white terrain resembling a field of sugar cubes. They moved on. Within the hour, they reached the timberline, and though still post-holing in waist-deep snow, they had come safely down from the pass and back into the trees. The sense of relief was potent and long overdue. In the late afternoon, they rested at 11,000 feet in a pure stand of Douglas fir. The cold front had pushed through, driven out the clouds and scrubbed the sky into high-gloss Colorado blue. They dug out a spot in the snow, sat leaning against one of the old firs, eating gorp, sharing a bottle of water. "Drink as much as you need," Scott said. "I have a filter with me so I can pump more." "I feel guilty drinking this," Abigail said, "knowing my dad doesn't have this luxury." Scott broke open a pistachio, plucked out the nut meat. "You getting dehydrated isn't gonna..."
"Lawrence is your father?"
"We aren't close. He left us when I was very young." Abigail lifted the Nalgene bottle, and as she unscrewed the lid to take another sip, it twitched. The tree trunk between them went psst. A piece of bark flew off, struck her face, and 2 streams of water shot out from the middle of the bottle, one arcing into the snow, the other into her lap. Abigail said,
"What the..."
The delayed report of a high-powered rifle broke out above them in the cirque. Scott tackled her into the snow.
"How close?" she whispered.
There was a 3-second lag from when the bullet hit the bottle to the gunshot. "If he's shooting one of the bigger cartridges, he's maybe 1,500 yards away, just under a mile, probably scoping us from the ledges below the pass." A bullet tore through Scott's pack, followed by fleeting silence, then a resounding gunshot. "I don't know how the hell he's got us sighted up in these woods," Scott said. "You run first. I'll be right behind you. Don't run in a straight line. Zigzag between the trees. Make yourself a harder target. Go." Abigail scrambled up out of the snow, took off downhill through the firs. After 10 steps, she heard another gunshot, glanced back, didn't see Scott, kept running, thinking,
"The bullet'll hit you. You'll go down. Might never hear the shot."
She came out of the forest into the little glade where they'd camped 3 nights ago, and on the other side she ducked behind a tree. When she caught her breath, Abigail peeked around the corner, spotted Scott running toward her across the glade. He stepped behind the tree, threw his pack down in the snow.
"What are you doing?"
she said. "I want to see where this fucker is." He unzipped the top of his pack, jammed his hand inside, and pulled out a small black leather case, which he unsnapped. He took out a pair of 8-power Nikon binoculars and lay flat in the snow. Propped up on his elbows, so the lenses just barely poked above the surface, he brought the eye cups to his eyes, adjusted the focus knob, and glassed the cirque. After a minute, he said,
"There you are.
Shit. I thought we were making much better time. You want to see?" Abigail got down in the snow with him and took the binoculars. Scott guided her finger to the focus knob.
"First find the pass," he said.
She glassed the buttresses and couloirs of the cirque in the big sphere of magnification, then the jagged rock outcropping of the saw blade, 2,000 feet above and a mile away. The sharp rocks and snow glinting in the sun, a deep, shimmering quality to the condensed air.
"Okay, I've got it," she said.
"See the trail we took?"
"Yeah."
"Just follow it on down." Abigail adjusted the focus, slowly glassing the ledges, tracing their steep descent down the back wall of the cirque.
"I see him," she said.
"That's the guy who locked you in the mine?"
"Yeah, that's Quinn."
Minuscule among the huge broken crags, Quinn postholed at a fast lope just past the 5th switchback in that silver and black down jacket. He toted a backpack and a scope-bearing rifle slung over his shoulder.
"Oh my God," she said. "He's almost down from the ledges."
Abigail lowered the binoculars.
"He's going to catch up to us, Scott, and he has our tracks to follow."
Scott's face paled, and she wondered if it was from blood loss or fear. He said, "We have to get down below the snow line." 76. Abigail and Scott worked their way down through the trees at a lung-wrenching jog. The valley broadened. They passed into a forest of spruce and aspen. At 10,000 feet, the snow was only knee-deep. At 9,000, just a foot lay on the ground. Abigail's tailbone felt like it had split, and she saw blood in Scott's tracks, his right boot squishing. A little past 6 o'clock in the evening, they arrived at the alpine lake where they'd lunched on Sunday afternoon. The sun had slipped below the valley wall an hour ago, and a fleet of leaden clouds invaded from the west. Scott's Sherpa put them at 8,700 feet, but they still stood in snow to their ankles.
"How you holding up?"
Abigail said. He squatted by the bank.
"Fucking agony. What can I do?"
"Nothing. We just have to keep descending. Think Quinn's stopping?" They pushed on past the spruce-rimmed lake, down and down, faster than they'd moved all day. Light dwindling, clouds thickening up, dark and without texture. An immense sheet of metal stretched across the sky. They tramped through occasional patches of bare ground. Then there were more bare spots than snow-covered ones. Then, just tatters of wet snow on the tree-shaded north aspects. Then no snow at all, but only the naked floor of the forest, spongy and saturated from 2 days of cold November rain. At dusk, they came into the aspen grove. Slim, silvered trunks as far as they could see, some marred with arbor glyphs, carved graffiti from the Old West. Abigail hadn't noticed it before, but the aspens had eyes, hundreds of them all around her, mysterious dark bark scars from where old branches used to be, watching her from every side. Scott collapsed.
"We have to decide," he said, breathless, "whether to stop for the night or keep going."
"Could you even go on any farther?"
He shook his head.
"I don't think so, but maybe you can. I'm not going anywhere at night and alone with this lunatic out here. Besides, I'm wiped out too."
"Well, we're out of the snow, so we'd better find a place to camp."
Scott struggled to his feet. "The valley's a half mile wide here. Let's get ourselves out of the middle of it."
As they headed east through the aspen, Abigail felt her stomach tighten. The imminent threat to her life notwithstanding, there was still something unnerving about being in the wilderness with night coming on and watching the sky lose its light above you. A sinking feeling rooted in the most basic of primal fears, the woods after dark. They came to a stream. It flowed stronger than Abigail remembered,
and it seemed two lifetimes ago that she'd watched Scott flyfish this same watercourse 2 miles up the valley for their supper. "Stream's up," he said. "I'm going to filter some water, since we can't camp here. First place Quinn will look for us is along this stream. We'd never hear him coming." They climbed down into the gully and found a place at the water's edge beside a pool protected from the chaos of the main current and clogged with aspen leaves that looked like gold coins floating in the water. Scott dug the pure filter out of his pack and inserted the two hoses into the bottom. He fitted the end of one with a bottle adapter and screwed it onto an empty Nalgene bottle. The other hose he dropped in the pool. Abigail sat beside him in the fading light, watching Scott pump the filter and holding the newly filled bottles between her legs. She kept looking back up the gully. Scott had been right. Streamside, you couldn't hear a thing but the chatter of water flowing over rocks. Approaching footsteps would be lost in the noise. When he'd topped off 5 Nalgene bottles, Scott disassembled the filter and packed everything away. There would be no dry, easy crossing. They forded the stream, 15 feet across and thigh deep in the middle, so strong that Abigail had to brace herself and lean into the current to keep her footing. The water had been snow less than an hour ago. Her legs burned and her lungs contracted from the freezing shock of it. They climbed onto the bank and up the muddy gully on the other side, hiked several hundred yards over a forest floor carpeted with brilliant aspen leaves. The air smelled metallic and stale. It began to rain. Scott turned to her, said, "I see where we'll camp tonight." And Abigail followed him into a thicket of choke cherry. Not much space between the shrubs, but enough to conceal a tent. 77. 4 nylon bags lay spread out on the ground, containing the footprint, poles, pegs, and the tent itself, a bright red Hilberg. They unrolled the footprint in a cleared area between the choke cherry shrubs, and Scott unfolded the tent while Abigail took out the poles and locked them together. In the deepening darkness as the rain set in, they slipped the 3 poles into the tent sleeves and staked out the guy lines. Scott's hands shaking so badly that he could barely grip the pegs to jam them into the softened ground. With the tent pitched, they threw their packs into the roomy vestibule, climbed in, and zipped themselves inside. Scott shivered uncontrollably, and he slurred his words. Abigail said, "You have spare clothes in here?" He nodded. "Why don't you get in the tent and take off your wet ones?" Scott unzipped the inner tent and crawled inside. While he stripped, Abigail pulled everything out of his pack, realized she didn't feel right either. Her motor coordination was disrupted, and she had trouble focusing on the task at hand. "I can't find your sleeping bag," she said. "Bottom compartment." She dragged out the marmot compression bag, tossed it in with the thermarest and his bag of extra clothes. Then she unlaced her boots, pulled off her socks, all her soaked clothing, and climbed in. Scott twisted shut the air valve on the thermarest, laid his sleeping bag on top of it. He wriggled inside, said, "Get in with me. We both have hypothermia." Abigail climbed into the down mummy bag and zipped them up. Scott spooned her. She could feel him shaking against her, their legs so cold, like malleable ice. "I should really get us something to eat and drink," she said. "Just stay here with me for a minute. Get some body heat going." They lay shivering together, listening to the rain patter on the tent. The sky detonated. Thunder shook the ground and decayed like a shotgun blast. Abigail thinking it sounded so different from East Coast thunder. In the West, it was deeper, right on top of you, and seemed to fade forever.
7 Please insert disc number 8.